Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our dive into the news. And I can exclusively reveal this week that one of us has bought a 10-year-old Ford Fiesta as their next car. And I will let you to work out who that is, whether it's our National Director, John Stevens. Good morning, John.
Good morning. And that car is, in fact, 14 years newer than the car I had before that.
Excellent work.
Oh, that's giving away the answer.
Associate National Director, Adrian Reynolds, as well. Good morning,
Spanish
Adrian.
Car driver.
Yeah, well, he does drive a Spanish car. Well, welcome to the podcast. Been loads going on in the news, which we'll get to in a couple of minutes. This past week, though, at FIEC, we had our planters conference, didn't we? Second time we've run it. A huge encouragement to gather people together who are planting churches, John.
Yeah, it was great. Both Adrian and I were there. It was run by Graham Bynan, who's our Associate National Director. About 55 church planters at various stages of planting, some established plants, some thinking about planting, some just about to begin. And it was to encourage them and equip them for church planting. It's a key part of our gospel vision to reach the nation. So encouraging that FIEC churches are planting. We're seeing about 12 new churches planted a year. Mm. We know of at least 9 that are in progress at the moment in a whole variety of different contexts across the country. So yeah, we're really thrilled that church planting is happening. Over the past 15 years, there have been a sort of a considerable number of FIEC church plants. And I think what's really encouraging is it's out of a gospel vision, a desire to see people reached with the gospel. There are also lots of churches that are thinking of planting because they're pretty full and they're wondering how can they grow and expand their gospel ministry. So yeah, it was a great time. Di Hanke preaching from God's word powerfully and passionately, encouraging us to kind of trust in Christ, be shepherded by him. I thought it was a great time.
Phil, I put on my chunky church planters watch, my Czech shirt and my fake beard. I thought that's what you had to do at a planters conference.
Honestly, these stereotypes.
And seriously, one of the things that thrilled me was just seeing the diversity of people who were there. There was not many Czech shirts in evidence, actually. So people from a variety of backgrounds planting into all kinds of different situations and revitalization too, not just planting. And I think that's hugely heartening. There's not this kind of one form of planting, you know, one stereotypical planter. Actually, all kinds of people were planting in all kinds of different places, which is exactly what the country needs. So really heartening.
I think what's great is there's loads of experience in FIEC of planting across all kinds of different sorts of
plants.
It's
been a long-term church planting network, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we can support and help. So our church plant recognition enables churches to access funds to help them be set up. We've got church planting coaches who are able to help. We're able to match people up with mentors for helping. So there's all sorts of ways in which we can help and support people who want to church
plant.
What
are the stats, John? About one church a month on average, something like that being planted?
Yeah. And it's worth saying, giving a plug to church plant recognition status, because if you are planting a church, you can get $2,500, $3,000 towards the setup of your CIO and your constitution if you're a recognised FIEC plant. And that's a great way to give you firm foundations for your governance and stuff going into the future, which is great. While we're talking about events, Adrian, Thrive and the Ministry Wives Retreat, bookings are open for those, taking place in May.
That's right, two really important conferences in our calendar. Thrive is for women in ministry. The Ministry Wives Retreat,
as it suggests,
is for ministry wives. And it's really important to us that we help women who are serving in ministry in different capacities to flourish. So our two directors of women's ministry, Eleanor and Rachel, will be running those. Bookings are open. They're a great time. I've often tried to get along to them when I can. I can't this year because I'm at other things. It's just thrilling, really, to see the way that women are serving and giving themselves to the work of Christ and gaining encouragement and help and all the tools they need to do that. So yeah, don't just think about whether you should go. Perhaps if you're a woman in ministry listening to this, whether you should go. I think your church should be thinking about whether you have people you could send. And I think that's especially true for the Wives Conference. A lot of people who come on the Wives Conference pay for themselves. But actually, I think a church should see that as a way of supporting the pastor and his family, is paying for the wife to come to the Ministry Wives Retreat.
We'll put links to both of those in the show notes. And terrifyingly, John, 5 weeks on Monday is Rising Lights.
It is. We're really looking forward to that in Torquay, 6th to the 10th of April. It's our new Easter event, filling the space that Word Alive used to be in. We're wonderfully encouraged. We've had to close children's bookings because we've had so many bookings. Something like 674 kids are going to be coming. Still open for adults and students to come. We'd love you to be there. It's an opportunity to hear great Bible teaching, a whole range of seminars on issues in the culture and in the Christian life, evening celebrations to lift our hearts, opportunity to gather with Christians from all around the country. So please do come and join us.
Yeah, we always ask. And don't forget the mini golf tournament.
Well, I said terrifyingly because it's just coming up on the outside lane very, very quickly now. But we're nearly there. And praise God for all that's been achieved in that so far. So really excited for all that. All those links will be in the show notes. Brothers, lots going on in the news for us to talk about. Let's mention a couple of things in passing. So this past week, I think we've seen the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. President Zelensky again.
Well, the second invasion, we ought to say. Yeah,
but President Zelensky speaking just very powerfully once again about where this is at. It's just horrifying to see it still ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah, go on, John. Yeah.
I think all we can do is grieve over that. Yeah. 4 years, who would have imagined it would have lasted that long? Actually, the Ukrainians have stood firm remarkably.
Mm. I mean, the Russians were at the gates of Kiev, weren't they? Mm.
And Russian casualties are immense. The numbers of Russians who are being killed just on a monthly basis is huge. I think it's something like 35,000 or more than that. So it's an absolute tragedy for Russia and its people as well. And we just pray for God to bring about a just peace and resolution. Can rejoice that there has been great spiritual work done in Ukraine in this period of time. All the reports from those that we know who are evangelical believers in Ukraine is that although this has been an incredibly tough time, at the same time, there's been remarkable spiritual openness and growth of the gospel.
And we've talked before, Adrian, about continuing to persevere in prayer, even when things fall out of the headlines.
I think that's right. And I think one of the interesting things about the situation now is that lots of churches in the UK will know Ukrainians positively and personally because of the number of Ukrainians who have come to this country and the connections we've had maybe through mission organizations or whatever. This is no longer just an abstract place on a map. Actually, lots of us will know Ukrainians. Even in our small church, that's the case. Mm. And so I think there's an opportunity not just to pray for the national situation, but actually to pray for people we know and to bear them up before the Lord.
It was interesting you said that. One of the Ukrainians in our church stood at the front very powerfully and said, pray for Ukraine, please pray for Ukraine. And she was really pleading that we wouldn't cease in praying for her country.
Yeah. It's worth recognizing that Ukraine has only been able to stand, although they have been fighting on the front line because of the resources that have been provided by the West, by others, money, arms, expertise that have helped with that. So at one level, we are involved, and some of the challenges in the economy, the availability of public finances because of our willingness to support them. You might say there's a parallel with that in gospel ministry. We are involved in a spiritual battle, and actually many churches are only able to effectively continue in their spiritual warfare of evangelism and raising up people in Christ because of the support and the help that they get from others, that actually they're not able to do it entirely on their own. They need that ongoing support. And at one level, FIEC is all about that. It's about how churches can work together, support one another in the work of the gospel. And I think there's just a sort of a pattern there that also speaks into our own willingness to give sacrificially to others to enable them to stand firm and to be able to continue in the spiritual battle.
Let's move on and talk about waking up to a new Green Party MP this morning. So the Gorton and Denton by-election took place yesterday. The Greens won 4,000 plus majority, I think, which was not what the polls were suggesting. There's all sorts of threads we could pull about this. So there have been claims overnight that there was family voting amongst Muslim communities, which is illegal. That will be a police matter. It will come to bear, I'm sure, in the fullness of time. But I think even those who are on the reform side saying this morning, that probably didn't affect the final result, which was a resounding win for the Green Party. We're seeing politics fragmenting. It was basically a three-horse race yesterday between Reform, the Greens, and Labour. The Greens winning that. And I think the question I would be really keen to ask is: you've now got in Gorton and Denton, you've got people with polarised different views. We can see that in church, can't we? People have polarised different views, not just about politics, but perhaps about theological matters. So, for example, you might have somebody who is very, very strong on the charismatic gifts in your church. Perhaps there's a group who are very, very strong on a particular type of eschatology. How do you lead when you've got that kind of divided viewpoint
in your
church?
I think it's even more kind of nuanced than that, Phil, just to add to your description of it. Because I think it's not just that people have polarized issues, but they've become single issue voters. Mm. So I think that's certainly how Reform are presenting it this morning. I think there's some truth in that, that people are voting for the party who do the one thing on this one issue that they want. And I think there is a parallel there into church life, because you do get churches where people differ on major issues, and there's a question we can explore there about how you might lead through that. But actually, obviously, often the most difficult situations are when you get people who have different opinions, and that is the biggest thing to them, and almost the only thing. You often get that with views on eschatology. You often get that with views on other issues over which Christians disagree, that this becomes the issue and they can't see beyond that. And I think that's what's happening in politics. It's not just becoming polarized, it's becoming narrowed in the issues over which people are selecting to vote. So I think the days when you would look at a manifesto and have a broad look at a manifesto and say, well, I'm interested in what this party's foreign policy is and what their education policy is and what their policy is about this and policy is about that, I think those days seem to have gone, and people are basically voting, well, is this party agree with me on issue A or not?
Yeah.
So I think actually that's harder for church leaders, because you have people who not only feel strongly about issues, but for whom this is the test case of orthodoxy. That actually, if you agree with me, then you're orthodox, and if you don't, you're not.
And that happens, I guess, when people choose churches, John?
I mean, people will choose churches on the basis of perhaps one particular thing that they want to see reflected in that church. And the challenge for leaders is obviously you're having to present often a position across a whole range of different areas of church life. I mean, it is interesting. I think one can't draw too much from this election. I think it's unique circumstances and its situation. Obviously, there is a sharpness of division. There seems to be a polarisation. It's the centre parties that seem to be losing support. Obviously, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the government. In actual fact, some of the policies that Reform are advocating and the Greens are advocating are actually quite similar. So the Green candidate who won in the end was speaking about issues of cost of living, the inability to work and be able to have a good life simply from working, the desire to want to reshape society. And a large number of Reform voters would echo some of those thoughts as well. So there's sometimes a danger of overplaying the degree of division on issues. The question becomes which group, which personality, which individual you think best represents your position. So in leadership, there's also a desire on the part of leaders to try to find that common ground and to recognise that even though positions might be expressed quite sharply and associated with particular leaders that you might follow, there might actually be more common ground to develop. And in the end, whoever is in leadership has got to lead for the whole group. So the new Green MP has got to be representing the entire constituency. And as a constituency MP, will no doubt be dealing with issues from all sorts of people from all different backgrounds, with all who have voted for different parties, but yet to faithfully represent them and act on their behalf. So I think there's a lesson there for leaders that even if you have strong opinions, you do actually have to lead for the whole of the people that you are serving, not simply pursuing a narrow personal agenda. And I think that's a danger that church leaders can fall into.
You also need documents and governing instruments that are going to serve you. So I think it's important to be clear about what your basis of faith is. I think every church should have their basis of faith on their website. I think churches that don't do that, I think that's a poor position. I think we need to be open about what we believe. I think we need to be clear if there are other things that we do and believe that perhaps aren't in our basis of faith. We have a document called our Doctrinal Distinctives at our church, which just explains where we stand on some of these secondary issues. It's not in the basis of faith. So it's not that you have to agree with it to be a member of the church, but in order to be a member of the church, you have to understand this is the church's position.
And you know where you stand if you join the church.
So I think documents like that can be very, very helpful. I think the least helpful position is where you take a very firm view as a church on a position that's not stated anywhere. Because people could rightly say, well, hang on a minute, where does this come from? You know, it's not on your basis of faith. You seem to believe it very firmly. So I think we need to be upfront about what we believe. And I think evangelicals should have nothing to hide there. And I just think we need to be honest that in the past, we have often added in things to to unwritten bases of faith. I think lots of churches have done that. Even movements have done that. Over time, things become sort of ingrained as, oh, well, of course you believe this, don't you? And actually the answer is, no, that's not what we are. People, for example, assume that FIC as an association is Credo Baptist. Well, we're not. We're Baptistic, so we believe in baptism, but we have both churches that practice adult baptism and an infant baptism in the FIC. And I think we have to we have to be true to what our documents are. That's really important, and that's true for a church as well.
I think another challenge for leaders in politics, you're trying to obviously get as many people to vote for you as you possibly can. The great danger is then you can appeal to people's baser instincts. I simply offer them what they want, say everything to everybody in order to garner as much support as possible. Christian leadership requires far more responsibility than that. Sometimes the people who support us, they need to be rebuked and corrected in some of the views that they might hold, not simply indulged in those views. And I think actually that's one of the challenges of Christian leadership, is that we need to be setting the example of putting forward what we believe is biblically right and biblically true, not just simply saying what people want to hear, or actually playing to their fears, and indeed indulging their sins. Leadership requires the ability to be able to address those issues. And I think that's one of the challenges for us as leaders. Even our core supporters, if we might put it like that, sometimes need to be corrected in the views that they hold
Give us a for instance on that, John.
Well, I think a for instance on that might be on a particular issue culturally or politically. People might have very strong views. They might have, for example, very negative views about Muslims that could easily sort of spill over into sort of Islamophobia. There's a danger of playing into that or bringing a gospel perspective to it that says you some of your concerns are right, but actually the way that you're expressing that and the way you're speaking about other people is unacceptable from a biblical perspective. It might be the way that you're treating other Christians who you disagree with, that the way you speak about them and the way that you judge them really isn't appropriate. They're not really false teachers and heretics. They're just those who have a different Christian opinion. Those are just two examples of ways in which you can play to the gallery, whereas actually what we're called to do is preach the word, and the word will be challenging to every group as we're made into the likeness of Christ. We're not politicians, ultimately. We're pastors who are preaching and teaching the word of God to transform people into the likeness of Jesus.
Wise words. Let's talk about something that's happened for the first time since the Civil War in this last couple of weeks, and that is the arrest of a member of the royal family. So Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. He denies any wrongdoing. Yeah. He's now been what's called released under investigation, which is a bit different to being released on bail. Peter Mandelson was then arrested on suspicion of the same charge a few days later. He's been released on police bail. When Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was arrested, the King said, "The law must take its course," which is interesting. So there was no sense in which there was a defensiveness there. But it's been very interesting to watch something that hasn't happened since 1646 play out. And we don't know the rights and wrongs of it, but there is an important lesson there, isn't there, that nobody is above the law.
I think that's absolutely right. And of course, it's worth saying, actually, it's not that there's been no wrongdoing in the royal family since the time of Charles I. Mm. In actual fact, what's happened, if you could go through the history, there are numerous examples of wrongdoing committed by members of the royal family. And generally, that has not been dealt with. And so I think actually this is a sort of a statement that nobody is above the law. That sort of deference that's been shown towards the royal family in the past has given way to a right accountability. And I think, yes, both instances reveal to us that nobody is above the law. At this stage, it's just investigations that are taking place, and the police are rightly doing that. The individuals concerned seem to have been treated in the same way as any other person in terms of they're being arrested, they're being held, they're being questioned. I think it's right and good that everybody is ultimately equally accountable before the law, that favouritism is not shown. And actually, that's just a reminder to us. That's what it means, that there is the rule of law. That is a good thing. And again, from a biblical perspective, every single human being is accountable to God. Mm. Nobody is above the law. Nobody is, because of who they are, because of their status, exempt from full accountability. It's a reminder to us that we will all have to stand before the bar of God's judgment in the end and answer for our lives and what we've done.
Mm. Adrian?
Well, I mean, they're going a bit further than the law, actually. The College of Policing rules say that a suspect shouldn't be named. He was named by the BBC on the morning he was arrested, which was an extraordinary turn of events, because the last time the BBC did that with Cliff Richard, they got into terrible trouble and had to pay a huge amount of money. But the palace had issued a statement almost at the same time saying it was Andrew. And so that kind of given credibility to it. So I think actually what's happening is the authorities are going beyond to try and show their impartiality. And I think there is a lesson there. I think sometimes we can overstep as well. I think, you know, there are processes to go through and there are rules to go through. It's worth saying, of course, that the offence for which he's been arrested is not the offence for which all the headlines mm-hmm. have been. And I think for some people, that's immensely frustrating. There are obviously a large number of victims of Epstein, and there are questions about how much was Mandelson involved in that, how much was Andrew involved in that. We just don't know the answers to those things. One way or the other. And it sort of seems to be frustrating. It's a bit like Al Capone being investigated for tax fraud. It sort of feels like a let-off at some ways. And some people will be very angry that there doesn't seem to be any progress made in some of these more salacious crimes rather than misuse in a public office. And I think we have to accept sometimes that processes are also limited. There are frustrations that aren't going to get resolved this side of eternity, which I find immensely frustrating. And I think we are supposed to feel the frustration of it. And I think that's why there's a place for lament in the Bible, that there are things that just aren't right. And we have to acknowledge that and say we can't do anything about it. And we're sorrowful about that. And we're sad about that. And we're sad for victims. But it is, you sort of feel that frustration, don't you? You want there to be justice for people who have been badly and criminally treated. But equally, sometimes it's just not possible. It's just not possible. And we have to live somehow with the imbalance of that and the injustice of it in this imperfect world.
I think that's right. And that's because, again, biblically and in the law, you can only act on the basis of evidence.
That's right.
So what's the reason why this action has been taken is the release of the Epstein documents has shown the passing of information about trade and other areas. Indeed. To Jeffrey Epstein. So it's that new evidence that has led to action. Presumably there hasn't been any new evidence revealed that has enabled any charges to be brought or investigation to be launched in relation to some of the allegations of sexual abuse and sexual trafficking, or not against specific individuals. Of course, it still remains the case that not all of the Epstein material has been released. Millions of documents have still not been released by the FBI in America. So it may well be that more ought to come out. And there is an argument that ought to be brought out so that right scrutiny can be exercised. But in the end, all processes are limited by actually evidence. And biblically, having evidence to prove something is hugely significant. I've just been reading through Mark 14 and 15 in the trial of Jesus, and the evidence is crucial. You in a sense have to act on the basis of what is proved. And of course, in that instance, basically false evidence was presented or no evidence was presented. So the need for evidence is a really important
thing. How do you deal with things in church then when it's just one person's word against another? That is a form of evidence, isn't it? It still needs scrutiny. It still needs process. You don't dismiss it because you say it's not firm evidence. You still have to investigate that, don't you?
You absolutely do. And it will depend on the weight of the persons, who they are, maybe some track record, whether there's any other corroboration. I mean, the Bible generally says you want corroboration of what has happened. But you're right. One of the most difficult situations that is often irresolvable is two people, and only two people, who give very differing stories of something that took place. And in the absence of anything else, it's actually quite difficult in those circumstances to prove what in fact took place. That's why the criminal standard is that very high, you've got to be sure. In other words, you know, no reasonable doubt
beyond reasonable
that doubt. Something has happened. Yeah. And that is to protect people against false allegations.
Should we have the same standard in church life?
It depends on what area in church life it's involved. So even in the law, there's a different standard between civil matters and criminal matters. It's the most serious matters that have the highest level of evidential proof behind them. And I think those are principles that are actually derived from a biblical framework that have been established over centuries that recognize that we're not omniscient. And as you say, we can't always resolve everything at a human level. But we have to try to bring some kind of objective assessment of what is available to us. And yes, people will feel they haven't either received justice or they haven't been fairly heard. Whereas in fact, what's happened is perhaps the evidence just simply doesn't lead to a conclusion. It's interesting, Scotland has always had the verdict of not proven, which was a way of saying the evidence doesn't show one way or another. Actually, they're about to abolish that because, again, it leaves something hanging over people unresolved. But it was at least a recognition that there's a situation in which we just can't tell what the real circumstances were here.
Well, both men arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. One, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, has been released under investigation. Peter Mandelson released on bail. We await to see what happens next with that. Brothers, let's talk about a couple of stories in relation to free speech that have been making the news this week. So one is related to the BAFTAs. So this is the story. A chap called John Davidson, who has Tourette's syndrome. That's when you have involuntary tics and you shout things out involuntarily in public places.
Some people do.
Some people, that's how it presents for John. So he was at the BAFTAs because his life has inspired the film I Swear, which was nominated at the BAFTAs. He called out a racial slur when two black men were on stage presenting an award, which wasn't then edited out of the feed, and it was broadcast on the BBC when it was shown a couple of hours later. That has led to a huge sort of backlash against John Davidson for using this term, others defending him because of his Tourette syndrome. It's been quite interesting to watch that play out on both sides. But the other free speech story we've got this week has been about a Christian preacher in Whitechapel in London. A group of Muslim men tried to stop him from preaching and asked the police to intervene. The policewoman wouldn't intervene from the Met Police. The WPC said, no, I'm not intervening. I'm sorry that you're offended, but actually
she's a police officer. We don't call
WPC. Sorry, we're not calling that anymore. I beg your pardon. So she was very, very firm that, you know, they might have been offended, but it was fine that they were offended because they could speak about their faith in the same free way that the Christian preacher was speaking about his faith. It's interesting, isn't it? What is offensive? How do we define that? And what does that mean for free speech?
Go on, you go first, John. You're the lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole load of things going on there, I think. Firstly, I think commend the policewoman in that situation.
The female police officer. We've already corrected that. Sorry.
There was a street preacher preaching the gospel. Muslim men were saying that he shouldn't be able to. In fact, their claim was this is a Muslim area. Mm. So I'm not sure it was a claim of being offended. It was more that he shouldn't be here and shouldn't be allowed to do this here. And I think she rightly said he has every right to do that. Mm. Her response to them was, if you don't want to listen, walk away and don't listen. He wasn't saying anything offensive. Mm. There was nothing racist in his comments. So in that sense, his right to be able to speak was defended. There isn't an absolute right on the streets to say whatever you want to in whatever way you want to.
Wherever
you want. So hate speech would not be legitimate. He clearly was not acting in that way, and his right to speak was defended. So in fact, I think the really important thing there is no-go areas for Christians or others who want to speak in ways that are not hateful and not offensive. So grateful for the police there. Actually, one of the senior Met leaders commended what was said there, and I think that's right and appropriate, and it's good to see that.
The law is on our side in those situations,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And there's a great little Christian Institute guide about street preaching, which we'll put a link to in the notes.
Yeah.
The instance of the BAFTAs is slightly different. And here, the speech, because of the Tourette's, was involuntary in that sense. It was offensive, and in many contexts, that speech would be regarded as hate speech that wouldn't be allowed. You don't find many people arguing for an absolute freedom of speech that will use racial slurs like that whenever they want to. So here was somebody who was speaking involuntarily. There are all sorts of issues of the wisdom of the BBC, both allowing that, the risk that would happen, the presence of a microphone near to him, whether or not people had been warned about that, and then the way it was rebroadcast and not dealt with. But there we were dealing with somebody who spoke involuntarily, but in a way that was offensive to a very large number of people. I think that's a reminder to us just to be very careful about the sensitivities, that even in a situation in which it's not a deliberate use of offensive language, the offence that's caused to people is very deep and very great. And we need to be cautious and careful to try to prevent incidents like that happening, I think. Mm.
And also, I think BAFTA didn't handle it particularly well. They didn't apologise to the two men in question on the stage. They sort of heard about it through the press. And I think when we do make mistakes about how we handle things, we need to be quick to own up to that. There needs to be quick forgiveness in the Christian life. We need to seek forgiveness promptly, and it needs to be given promptly, I think, if it's genuine repentance.
Interesting, there was a reform activist who was involved in the kind of election in Gorton, who was suspended from the party this week because he had used racial slurs on posts on X. Now, that is a deliberate example of the use of offensive speech. And again, quite rightly there, the party has suspended him. They're not claiming he's got the right to freedom of speech to say those things or whatever he wants. So freedom of speech is one of those difficult issues because nobody really believes in an absolute right to freedom of speech, to say anything to anyone, no matter how offensive, no matter how hateful. There have to be some limits to what people are willing to say. And I think the challenge in freedom of speech is very often what people want is they want the freedom to say what they believe, but they often want others not to have the freedom to say things that they think are kind of offensive. And I think it is a challenge. But the lesson to us as Christians is to constantly be careful of our speech. The Bible tells us we're to be gentle in our speech. We are to be cautious in the way that we speak.
Yes, no coarse joking.
Absolutely. Mm. So I think that we have to exercise a self-restraint, which is speaking the truth in love, but not offensively.
Mm. Ephesians is great on that, isn't it?
Yeah. One final thing, John, which I'm coming to you for. You want to tell us about...
I've got views too.
You've got views. Well, John wants to tell us about the toilets on the new United States aircraft carrier. That's all I've got.
This is a wonderful story I heard on the radio, which is the Gerald Ford, which is the biggest aircraft carrier in the world, cost $13 billion to prove, is currently in Crete, being refueled, possibly going to be involved in action against Iran. There is a massive problem with the toilets on board.
And what is the problem with them, John?
Well, there are 5,000 people on the toilets, and
there are 5,000 people on the toilets.
There are 5,000 people on the ship, and it has this highly sophisticated.
There are 600 toilets.
New system of toilets. A bit more like airline toilets with vacuum systems. Don't want to go into all of the details, but basically it doesn't work.
Right.
And the impact of that on the morale of the ship and the attention that's been, videos have been posted that you don't want to watch.
You have to queue for 45 minutes for the toilet.
It's a very simple thing. I actually now know far more about naval toilets because Admiral Lord West, the former First Sea Lord, gave a long explanation of the evolution over the last 50 years.
Are there more toilets on the USS Gerald R. Ford than there are in the entire British Navy?
Probably.
I don't think there are.
Actually, the lesson listening to it, the thing that it struck me, I actually think it seems a really silly thing, but it's massively important to people's lives and how they function. And I visit loads of churches around the country in the course of my job with FIEC, and I quite often visit the toilets. And there is a real diversity of the quality of toilets in church buildings. And I think the lesson I would want to say is actually that is a crucial area to invest in as a church. If you want people to feel comfortable, if you want them to feel welcomed, we might not think it, but actually the experience of the toilets is massively important. And if they are dirty, messy,
cold, smelly,
no cold water, no hot water, no proper soap. Basically, your toilets tell an awful lot about your welcome and how you treat people. And I think that it's probably an area of massive underinvestment in church life.
And it's relatively cheap to invest and produce good toilets. I mean, compared to sort of massive building programs.
Yeah. And if you want people to come in, particularly visitors and guests, particularly those with babies, women in particular, actually the quality of your toilets is a hugely important indication of basically your love and care for people. And I would advocate to churches, make sure that your toilets are sort of nice, functional, because they'll be the impression that people walk away with.
And on the 1st of April, we'll be launching the FIEC 2026 Good Toilet of the Year Award.
Well, there we are. You might not have come to this podcast for you, Bend advice, but we have delivered it. Excellent. Brothers, time has gone. Good to talk to you about what's been going on in the news. I hope this has helped you as you lead churches up and down the country. Do like, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll speak to you again in a couple of weeks. God bless.